Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over 5 recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top 5 countdown for the week. In number 5, we have the UK's initiative to promote a free trade area in the British Commonwealth. Critics of this proposal have decried it as Empire 2.0, but supporters say that it's the only pragmatic option once the UK finally leaves the EU. They claim that now is the time for Britain to diversify its erstwhile dependence on what is now the failing EU and intensify its relations with the non-Western realm that it used to preside over, and still does to some extent. See, the British Commonwealth already is kind of like an Empire 2.0, and the UK has always traditionally treated it that way whenever it had the opportunity to do so, especially the African parts. The relationship between the UK and India is a lot different than it used to be, but the same historical constant remains. London wants access to New Delhi's enormous marketplace, and it already has a sizable enough diaspora to powerfully lobby for it, especially since Prime Minister Modi regularly encourages his overseas compatriots to lead the way in bettering ties between their current place of residence and ancestral homeland. What this means is that there's a chance that the UK could reach a bilateral free trade deal with India, even if it's unsuccessful in clinching a multilateral one with it and the other members of the British Commonwealth, which is an important point to always keep in mind. Looking elsewhere in the Commonwealth, it'll probably be comparatively easier for the UK to bring Australia, New Zealand, and Canada on board, and they'll likely be in favor of this initiative, or at least doing so bilaterally with the UK in the post-Brexit reality. The issue, then, comes down to the inclusion of so many African countries, since there are major development asymmetries between the Western majority European members of the British Commonwealth and those in Africa. I'm not saying that their governments won't agree to this. Many of them might actually be delighted, in fact. But what concerned observers rightly note is that this could just simply be a replay of colonialism, albeit repackaged differently and minus the direct political component. Don't misunderstand me, guys. Free trade agreements aren't neocolonialism, but the intention of some of the actors involved may very well be. What I'm also getting at here is that most of the African members of the British Commonwealth are along the Indian Ocean Rim in East Africa, which is a major terminal point for Chinese investment and a crucial component of Beijing's One Belt, One Road global vision of new Silk Roads, primarily railroads in Kenya and Tanzania in this instance. There's also the fact that Tanzania and Mozambique are expected to become some of the world's largest LNG exporters in the next decade if all goes according to plan. So if you ask me, the UK is actually pretty clever in trying to reach a Commonwealth-wide free trade agreement, or at least bilateral trade pacts with many of its members, since this is a classic, albeit modernized, replay of the imperial tactics that it employed against its great power peers. Except this time, not fellow European colonialists like in the 19th century, but China and the new Cold War. The next one up is the EU's so-called two-speed plan and the uproar that it's causing in the bloc's periphery. Jean-Claude Juncker is the brains behind this proposal, but it expectedly led to backlash from Bulgaria, Hungary, and Slovakia, which are afraid of being left out of what they view to be the positive elements of EU membership, namely free travel and trade. These countries are correct in criticizing the idea as a two-speed plan because it segregates Western EU countries from their Eastern counterparts, or in other words, makes the bloc's original members its core, while the new ones are institutionalized as its periphery. I found this proposal very interesting because it's a combination of what I forecast over the summer in my analytical article for The Durant, titled Post-Brexit EU, Between Regional Breakdown and Full-Blown Dictatorship, in which I postulated that the EU would only have one of two futures, that of a hardcore dictatorship or a loose alliance of regional blocs. What Juncker is suggesting is a combination of the two, a full-blown dictatorship in Western Europe as a means of solidifying the core status of the bloc's oldest and leading members, and one or a combination of regional blocs along the periphery, possibly aligned according to the forecast that I described in my article. This could see either the Visegrad 4 becoming closer in response, or Poland carving out its own sphere of influence in Lithuania, Western Ukraine, and part of Slovakia, while Hungary does the same in the other half of Slovakia, Croatia, and parts of Serbia and Romania, for example. Regardless of how it turns out in practice, it's clear that this is the trajectory that the EU elite want to take the bloc on, a formal institutional segregation of its core and peripheral members, with the two sides disagreeing on the full-blown dictatorship aspect, aka intensified integration, and Brussels' control over member states' monetary and immigration policies. To wrap it all up, guys, the EU is undergoing radical and accelerated change, both in the direction of its already existing full-blown dictatorship trajectory, or the reverse path and our devolution into regional blocs, which will still probably retain some high-level strategic relations with the EU, such as what the post-Brexit UK is attempting to do. Though it'll be relatively easier for the peripheral members in a two-speed EU to do this. Hungary and the others want access to the open market for both trade and labor, while Brussels wants its second-speed underlings to open up their external borders to unrestricted immigration in response, thus precipitating a strategic standoff between the two, which probably won't end anytime soon. Third in our countdown are the anti-government protests in Albania. This story has been pretty much blacklisted by the mainstream media, but it's really so important, guys. Albania has been in the throes of a prolonged anti-government protest movement for the past few weeks, with the opposition refusing to go along with the authorities' plans to implement an EU and US-drafted judicial reform agreement which would facilitate the country's admission to the EU. When these protests are reported, however, they're always framed in the way of making the opposition out to be some kind of anti-European barbarians. But that's actually not true, because they're not against joining the bloc per se, but they just don't want external parties to have full control over their country, nor do they want to institutionalize the long-term rule of Prime Minister Edi Rama's Socialist Party of Albania through clever loopholes and witch hunts against political opponents. Due to Rama's endemic corruption and the de facto criminalization or mafiaization of the Albanian state, they want him to resign and be replaced by a technocratic government before parliamentary elections on the 18th of June. Which they also demand be conducted freely and fairly, unlike what they allege were the rigged ones of years past. The thing is, though, guys, that these protests have gotten a bit out of control, and that the government charged opposition leader Luzin Basha with, quote, inciting public violence, end quote, for allegedly encouraging his supporters to, as the state accuses him of, puncture car tires, break glass. Interpret this as you will, whether as a legitimate crackdown on a color revolution-like uprising, minus the foreign benefactors, of course, or as an authoritarian dictatorial crackdown on the democratic opposition. But what I want to focus on real quickly is how all of this relates to the recent ongoing drama in the Balkans, particularly in the Republic of Macedonia and the NATO-occupied Serbian province of Kosovo. I wrote a two-part article for the Moscow-based Oriental Review online journal in November 2015 called Greater Albania is a Myth to Preserve the Country's Unity, where I argue that there's a clear correlation between Albania's domestic turmoil, whether economic, political, or both, and its reactionary response by jingoistically promoting the fascist-era geopolitical project of so-called Greater Albania. At the time that I wrote it, there was, and still is, a large-scale Albanian immigrant exodus to the EU. But now we see that a political crisis is also unfolding in the country, though completely ignored by the mainstream media. It's therefore not a coincidence, then, that Edi Rama has supported the revival of fascist Albania in Macedonia through the so-called Albanian platform, and that he encouraged Kosovo-Albanian provocations against native Serbs in order to provoke a new conflict. Both of these are distractions designed to deflect domestic attention away from his and his cronies' corruption and towards foreign scarecrows. But for as destabilizing as they've already been, they don't seem to be fooling as many Albanians in Albania as before. And if Rama is ousted, however unlikely that it seems at the moment, then it might put the brakes on Washington's Greater Albania project, at least for now. Our runner-up is Trump's revised travel ban. Alright guys, this is going to be controversial and provocative, so brace yourselves in advance. I'm not going to go over the details of exactly how the new travel ban differs from its predecessor, but it's basically a light, more legal if you will, version, which pretty much just stops the allocation of new visas to people from a handful of Muslim countries while not inconveniencing green card holders, those who already have visas to travel to the US, and diplomats. Also, Iraq isn't on the list, though Syria, Iran, Yemen, Somalia, Libya, and Sudan are. Alright, I got it. We all know that this was somewhat of a politicized ban anyhow, which never genuinely intended to prevent terrorism. Otherwise, it would have targeted Saudi Arabia too. But that's not what I want to talk about today, because if you're listening to Radio Sputnik, then you probably already heard those points before. What I want to ask is, why? Not why is there a travel ban, but why do people from these American victimized countries want to travel to the land of their oppressor anyhow? I'm aware that there are family links, and also that regular citizens desire to have better living conditions and get paid in dollars, not their local currency, which they might somewhat mistakenly believe will make them comparatively richer and better well off than before. I'm not judging anyone, but I'm just asking these questions, however uncomfortable they may be. Maybe they just want to take a vacation to the US. Well, Okay, but what average Somalian can afford to do that and pay for the airfare, housing, living expenses, souvenirs, etc.? How about your average Iranian, which hates the American government, but importantly has very warm feelings about the American people? Why go to the Great Satan and give Uncle Sam the precious currency that you work so hard to earn and your sanctions afflict the country? Aren't there other places to go to? Or what about Syrians, the most oppressed of all six people right now? Why would they visit or want to immigrate to the U.S. after all that it did to their homeland? I'm not judging, remember. I know that there are deep family ties that have nothing to do with politics or the American government. But other than that, there are almost 200 other countries in the world to go to for whatever your reason might be right now. Plus, even President Assad spoke favorably about the first failed travel ban, telling Europe One Radio and TF1 Television in mid-February that, quote, "It's against the terrorists that would infiltrate some of the immigrants to the West." And that happened. It happened in Europe, mainly in Germany. I think the aim of Trump is to prevent those people from coming. It was not against the Syrian people. End quote. So, what if you think that it is against the Syrian and other people? Well, in that case, why would you even want to go to a country which you feel is discriminating against your compatriots and doesn't even want you? Exempting, of course, those who have already been there or have family living there. I, for one, would never want to go to such a place, let alone after they so rudely, as I might see it, ban me and my fellow nationals, or be discriminatory against people who hold the same political or religious ideas as me. But that's just me, to each their own. And remember, I'm not judging, but I felt that it was time that somebody made this point. At our top spot, we've got WikiLeaks Vault 7 CIA cyber weapon revelations and how they just frighteningly confirm that we all live in an Orwellian dystopia. There's no other way to say this, guys, but everything and everyone is being spied on. Vault 7 proves that the CIA built its own secret version of the NSA, and it's employing a wide arsenal of cyber weapons against literally every single modern technological device, be it smartphones, smart TVs, or smart cars, turning them into surreptitious microphones, video cameras, or as some suspect, even death cages when it comes to vehicles. I want to encourage you all to go to the WikiLeaks website, read the summarized report yourself, and follow any of the journalists and activists which plan to go through the data themselves and release up-to-date findings, because my 3-minute broadcast isn't nearly enough time to go through all the details. What I do want to emphasize while we still have the time, however, is that one of the most shocking facts to emerge from Vault 7 is that the CIA is capable of carrying out false flag cyber attacks, and that they can use their adversaries' hacking techniques and so-called signatures to pin the blame on someone else for whatever the cybercrime is that they commit. In practice, that relevantly means that all of these fake, so-called Russian hacking schemes might have just been false flag attacks carried out by the pro-Obama and Clinton-supporting elements of the deep state, which are obsessed with undermining Trump. It also lends credence to the president's allegations that Obama and his deep state people were spying on him before the elections. Since the range of tools that the CIA's secret NSA copycat institution has at its disposal gives the surveillance state ubiquitous influence over just about everything, I think that the most horrifying element of this whole scandal is that WikiLeaks source claims that the CIA lost control over all of its cyber weapons and that they're now being traded across the black market, which gives other countries and non-state actors theoretical access to these capabilities and suggests that their uncontrollable proliferation is giving rise to an arms race between different parties and non-state actors, the latter of which could possibly even include terrorist groups. The deep state has definitely gone wild and needs to be reined in, which is part of Trump's agenda and perhaps one of the key reasons why they hate him so much. The people who are tasked with protecting the U.S. have certainly abused their privileges, and it arguably looks like they really did leverage their power to interfere in America's domestic processes, whether the presidential campaign or the post-election deep state war, and try to pin it all on Russia. So guys, as a cliche but contemporarily relevant saying goes, who's watching the watchmen, and what needs to be done to bring them to justice? Alright guys, well there you have it. This wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for listening to my program. Hope you guys have a nice weekend. Thanks, and take care. Bye.